Full Dark, No Stars, Disc 12.
16. Inside the house, he whirled his sport coat onto the tree by the door and pulled her into his arms for a long kiss. She could taste champagne and sweet creme brulee on his breath. It was not a bad combination, although she knew if things happened as they might, she would never want either again. His hand went to her breast. She let it linger there, feeling him against her, then pushed him away. He looked disappointed but brightened when she smiled. "I'm going upstairs and getting out of this dress," she said. "There's Perrier in the refrigerator. If you bring me a glass with a wedge of lime, you might get lucky, mister." He broke into a grin at that, his old, well-loved grin. Because there was one long-established habit of marriage they had not resumed since the night he had smelled her discovery. Yes, smelled it, just as a wise old wolf may smell a poisoned bait and come rushing home from Montpelier. Day by day they had walled up what he was. Yes, as surely as Montresor had walled up his old pal Fortunato, and sex in the connubial bed would be the last brick. He clicked his heels and threw her a British-style salute, fingers to forehead, palm out. "Yes, ma'am."
"Don't be long," she said pleasantly. "Mama wants what Mama wants."
Going up the stairs, she thought,
"This will never work. The only thing you'll succeed in doing is getting yourself killed. He may not think he's capable of it, but I think he is."
Maybe that would be all right, though, assuming he didn't hurt her first, as he'd hurt those women. Maybe any sort of resolution would be all right. She couldn't spend the rest of her life looking in mirrors. She wasn't a kid anymore and couldn't get away with a kid's craziness. She went into the bedroom, but only long enough to toss her purse onto the table beside the hand mirror. Then she went out again and called,
"Are you coming, Bobby? I could really use those bubbles."
"On my way, ma'am, just pouring it over ice."
And here he came out of the living room and into the hall, holding one of their good crystal glasses up before him, at eye level like a comic opera waiter, weaving slightly as he crossed to the foot of the stairs. He continued to hold the glass up as he mounted them, the wedge of lime bobbing around on top. His free hand trailed lightly along the banister. His face shone with happiness and good cheer.
For a moment, she almost weakened. And then the image of Helen and Robert Shaverstone filled her mind, hellishly clear.
The son and his molested, mutilated mother floating together in a Massachusetts creek that had begun to grow lacings of ice at its sides.
"One glass of Perrier for the lady coming right up."
She saw the knowledge leap into his eyes at the very last second. Something old and yellow and ancient. It was more than surprise. It was shocked fury. In that moment, her understanding of him was complete. He loved nothing, least of all her. Every kindness, caress, boyish grin and thoughtful gesture, all were nothing but camouflage.
He was a shell. There was nothing inside but howling emptiness. She pushed him. It was a hard push, and he made a three-quarters somersault above the stairs before coming down on them, first on his knees, then on his arm, then full on his face.
She heard his arm break. The heavy Waterford glass shattered on one of the uncarpeted risers. He rolled over again and she heard something else inside him snap. He screamed in pain and somersaulted one final time before landing on the hardwood hall floor in a heap. The broken arm, not broken in just one place but in several, cocked back over his head at an angle nature had never intended. His head was twisted, one cheek on the floor, Darcy hurried down the stairs. At one point, she stepped on an ice cube, slipped, and had to grab the banister to save herself. At the bottom, she saw a huge knob now poking out of the skin on the nape of his neck, turning it white, and said, "Don't move, Bob. I think your neck is broken." His eye rolled up to look at her. Blood was trickling from his nose. That looked broken, too. And a lot more was coming out of his mouth, almost gushing out.
"You pushed me," he said. "Oh, Darcy, why did you push me?"
"I don't know," she said, thinking, "We both know." She began to cry. Crying came naturally. He was her husband and he was badly hurt.
"Oh, God, I don't know. Something came over me. I'm sorry. Don't move. I'll call 911 and tell them to send an ambulance."
His foot scraped across the floor.
"I'm not paralyzed," he said. "Thank God for that. But it hurts."
"I know, honey."
"Call the ambulance. Hurry."
She went into the kitchen, spared a brief glance for the phone in its charger cradle, then opened the cabinet under the sink.
"Hello? Hello? Is this 911?
She took out the box of plastic Glad bags, the storage size ones she used for the leftovers when they had chicken or roast beef, and pulled one from the box.
"This is Darcellan Anderson. I'm calling from 24 Sugar Mill Lane in Yarmouth. Have you got that?"
From another drawer, she took a dish wiper from the top of the pile. She was still crying.
"Nose like a fire hose," they'd said when they were kids. Crying was good. She needed to cry, and not just because it would look better for her later on. He was her husband. He was hurt. She needed to cry. She remembered when he still had a full head of hair. She remembered his flashy breakaway move when they had danced to Footloose. He brought her roses every year on her birthday. He never forgot. They had gone to Bermuda where they rode bikes in the morning and made love in the afternoon. They had built a life together, and now that life was over, and she needed to cry. She wrapped the dish wiper around her hand and then stuffed her hand into the plastic bag.
"I need an ambulance. My husband fell down the stairs. I think his neck might be broken. Yes, yes, right away."
She walked back into the hall with her right hand behind her back. She saw he had pulled himself away from the foot of the stairs a little, and it looked like he tried to turn over on his back. But at that, he hadn't been successful. She knelt down beside him.
"I didn't fall," he said. "You pushed me. Why did you push me?"
"I guess for the Shaverstone boy,"
she said, and brought her hand out from behind her back. She was crying harder than ever. He saw the plastic bag. He saw the hand inside clutching the wad of toweling. He understood what she meant to do. Perhaps he had done something like it himself. Probably he had. He began screaming, only the screams weren't really screams at all. His mouth was filled with blood. Something had broken inside of his throat, and the sounds he produced were more guttural growls than screams. She jammed the plastic bag between his lips and deep inside his mouth. He had broken a number of teeth in the fall, and she could feel the jagged stumps. If they tore into her skin, she might have some serious explaining to do. She yanked her hand free before he could bite, leaving the plastic bag and the dish wiper behind. She grabbed his jaw and chin. The other hand she put on top of his balding head. The flesh there was very warm. She could feel it throbbing with blood. She jammed his mouth shut on the wad of plastic and cloth. He tried to beat her off, but he only had one arm free. And that was the one that had been broken in the fall. The other was twisted beneath him. His feet paddled jerkily back and forth on the hardwood floor. One of his shoes came off. He was gurgling. She yanked her dress up to her waist, freeing her legs, then lunged forward, trying to straddle him. If she could do that, maybe she could pinch his nostrils shut. But before she could try, his chest began to heave beneath her, and the gurgles became a deep grunting in his throat. It reminded her of how, when she was learning to drive, she would sometimes grind the transmission trying to find second gear, which was elusive on her father's old Chevrolet Standard. Bob jerked, the one eye she could see bulging and cow-like in its socket. His face, which had been a bright crimson, now began to turn purple. He settled back onto the floor. She waited, gasping for breath, her face lathered with snot and tears. The eye was no longer rolling, and no longer bright with panic. She thought he was... Bob gave one final titanic jerk and flung her off. He sat up, and she saw his top half no longer exactly matched his bottom half. He had broken his back as well as his neck, it seemed. His plastic-lined mouth yawned. His eyes met hers in a stare she knew she would never forget, but one she could live with, should she get through this.
Dara!
He fell backward. His head made an egg-like cracking sound on the floor. Darcy crawled closer to him, but not close enough to be in the mess. She had his blood on her, of course, and that was all right. She had tried to help him, it was only natural, but that didn't mean she wanted to bathe in it. She sat up, propped on one hand, and watched him while she waited for her breath to come back. She watched to see if he would move. He didn't. When 5 minutes had gone by, according to the little jeweled Michelle on her wrist, the one she always wore when they went out, she reached a hand to the side of his neck and felt for a pulse there. She kept her fingers against his skin until she had counted all the way to 30. And there was nothing. She lowered her ear to his chest, knowing this was the moment where he would come back to life and grab her. He didn't come back to life, because there was no life left in him, no beating heart, no breathing lungs. It was over. She felt no satisfaction, let alone triumph, but only a focused determination to finish this and do it right, partly for herself, but mostly for Donnie and Pets. She went into the kitchen, moving fast. They had to know she'd called as soon as she could. If they could tell there had been a delay, if his blood had a chance to coagulate too much, for instance, there might be awkward questions. I'll tell them I fainted if I have to, she thought. They'll believe that. And even if they don't, they can't disprove it. At least, I don't think they can. She got the flashlight from the pantry, just as she had on the night when she had literally stumbled over his secret. She went back to where Bob lay, staring up at the ceiling with his glazed eyes. She pulled the plastic bag out of his mouth and examined it anxiously. If it was torn, there could be problems. And it was, in two places. She shone the flashlight into his mouth and spotted one tiny scrap of Glad bag on his tongue. She picked it out with the tips of her fingers and put it in the bag. Enough. That's enough, Darcellin. But it wasn't. She pushed his cheeks back with her fingers, first the right, then the left, and on the left side she found another tiny scrap of plastic stuck to his gum. She picked that out and put it in the bag with the other one. Were there more pieces? Had he swallowed them? If so, they were beyond her reach, and all she could do was pray they wouldn't be discovered if someone, she didn't know who, had enough questions to order an autopsy. Meanwhile, time was passing. She hurried through the breezeway and into the garage, not quite running. She crawled under the work table, opened his special hiding place, and stowed away the blood-streaked plastic bag with the dish wiper inside. She closed the hidey hole, put the carton of old catalogs in front of it, then went back into the house. She put the flashlight where it belonged. She picked up the phone, realized she had stopped crying, and put it back into its cradle. She went through the living room and looked at him. She thought about the roses, but that didn't work. It's roses, not patriotism, that are the last resort of a scoundrel, she thought, and was shocked to hear herself laugh. Then she thought of Donnie and Petra, who had both idolized their father, and that did the trick. Weeping, she went back to the kitchen phone and punched 911.
Hello, my name is Darcellan Anderson and I need an ambulance at...
Slow down a little, ma'am, the dispatcher said. I'm having trouble understanding you.
Good,
Darcy thought. She cleared her throat.
Is this better? Can you understand me?
Yes, ma'am, I can now. Just take it easy. You said you need an ambulance?
Yes, at 24 Sugar Mill Lane.
Are you hurt, Mrs. Anderson?
Not me, my husband. He fell down the stairs. He might only be unconscious, but I think he's dead.
The dispatcher said she would send an ambulance immediately. Darcy surmised she'd also send a Yarmouth police car, a state police car as well, if one were currently in the area. She hoped there wasn't. She went back into the front hall and sat on the bench there, but not for long. It was his eyes, looking at her, accusing her. She took his sport coat, wrapped it around herself, and went out the front walk to wait for the ambulance. 17. The policeman who took her statement was Harold Shrewsbury, a local. Darcy didn't know him, but did know his wife, as it happened. Arlene Shrewsbury was a knitting nut. He talked to her in the kitchen while the EMTs first examined Bob's body and then took it away, not knowing there was another corpse inside him. A fellow who had been much more dangerous than Robert Anderson, CPA.
Would you like coffee, Officer Shrewsbury? It's no trouble.
He looked at her trembling hands and said he would be very happy to make it for both of them. I'm very handy in the kitchen.
Arlene has never mentioned that, she said as he got up.
He left his notebook open on the kitchen table. So far, he had written nothing in it but her name, Bob's name, their address, and their telephone number. She took that as a good sign. No, she likes to hide my light under a bushel, he said. Mrs. Anderson, Darcy, I'm very sorry for your loss, and I'm sure Arlene would say the same.
Darcy began to cry again. Officer Shrewsbury tore a handful of paper towels off the roll and gave them to her.
Sturdier than Kleenex.
You have experience with this, she said.
He checked the bun, saw it was loaded, and flipped it on. More than I'd like. He came back and sat down. Can you tell me what happened? Do you feel up to that?
She told him about Bob finding the double date penny in his change from Subway and how excited he'd been, about their celebratory dinner at Pearl of the Shore and how he'd drunk too much, how he'd been clowning around. She mentioned the comic British salute he'd given when she asked for a glass of Perrier and lime,
how he'd come up the stairs holding the glass high like a waiter, how he was almost to the landing when he slipped. She even told about how she almost slipped herself on one of the spilled ice cubes while rushing down to him.
Officer Shrewsbury jotted something in his notebook, snapped it closed, then looked at her levelly.
Okay, I want you to come with me. Get your coat.
What? Where?
To jail, of course. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Go directly to jail. Bob had gotten away with almost a dozen murders, and she hadn't even been able to get away with one. Of course, he had planned his, and with an accountant's attention to detail. She didn't know where she'd slipped up, but it would undoubtedly turn out to be something obvious. Officer Shrewsbury would tell her on the way to the police station. It would be like the last chapter of an Elizabeth George.
My house, he said. You're staying with me and Arlene tonight.
She gaped at him. I can't.
You can, he said in a voice that brooked no argument. She'd kill me if I left you here by yourself. Do you want to be responsible for my murder?
She wiped tears from her face and smiled wanly. No, I guess not. But, Officer Shrewsbury.
Harry.
I have to make phone calls. My children, they don't know yet.
The thought of this brought on fresh tears, and she put the last of the paper towels to work on them. Who knew a person could have so many tears inside them? She hadn't touched her coffee, and now drank half of it in three long swallows, although it was still hot. I think we can stand the expense of a few long-distance calls, Harry Shrewsbury said. And listen, do you have something you can take? Anything of, calming nature?
Nothing like that, she whispered. Only Ambien.
Then Arlene will loan you one of her Valiums, he said. You should take one at least half hour before you start making any stressful calls. Meantime, I'll just let her know we're coming.
You're very kind. He opened first one of her kitchen drawers, then another, then a third. Darcy felt her heart slip into her throat as he opened the fourth. He took a dish wiper from it and handed it to her.
Sturdier than paper towels.
Thank you, she said. So much.
How long were you married, Mrs. Anderson?
27 years, she said.
27, he marveled. God, I am so sorry.
So am I, she said, and lowered her face into the dish towel. 18.
Robert Emery Anderson was laid to rest in Yarmouth's Peace Cemetery 2 days later.
Donnie and Petra flanked their mother as the minister talked about how a man's life was but a season. The weather had turned cold and overcast. A chilly wind rattled the leafless branches. BB&A had closed for the day, and everyone had turned out. The accountants in their black overcoats clustered together like crows. There were no women among them. Darcy had never noticed this before. Her eyes brimmed, and she wiped at them periodically with the handkerchief she held in one black-gloved hand. Petra cried steadily and without let-up. Donnie was red-eyed and grim. He was a good-looking young man, but his hair was already thinning, as his father's had at his age.
As long as he doesn't put on weight like Bob did, she thought, and doesn't kill women, of course. But surely that kind of thing wasn't hereditary, was it?
Soon this would be over.
Donnie would stay only a couple of days. It was all the time he could afford to take away from the business at this point, he said. He hoped she could understand that, and she said of course she did. Petra would be with her for a week and said she could stay longer if Darcy needed her. Darcy told her how kind that was, privately hoping it would be no more than 5 days. She needed to be alone. She needed not to think exactly, but to find herself again. To reestablish herself on the right side of the mirror. Not that anything had gone wrong, far from it. She didn't think things could have gone better if she had planned her husband's murder for months. If she had done that, she probably would have screwed it up by complicating things too much. Unlike for Bob, planning was not her forte. There had been no hard questions. Her story was simple, believable, and almost true. The most important part was the solid bedrock beneath it. They had a marriage stretching back almost 3 decades. A good marriage, and there had been no recent arguments to mar it. Really, what was there to question? The minister invited the family to step forward. They did so. Rest in peace, Pop, Donnie said, and tossed a clod of earth into the grave. It landed on the shiny surface of the coffin. Darcy thought it looked like a dog turd.
Daddy, I miss you so much, Petra said, and threw her own handful of earth. Darcy came last. She bent, took up a loose handful in her black glove, and let it fall. She said nothing. The minister invoked a moment of silent prayer. The mourners bowed their heads. The wind rattled the branches. Not too far distant, traffic rushed by on I-295. Darcy thought, God, if you're there, let this be the end. 19. It wasn't. 7 weeks or so after the funeral. It was the new year now, the weather blue and hard and cold. The doorbell of the house on Sugar Mill Lane rang. When Darcy opened it, she saw an elderly gentleman wearing a black top coat and a red muffler. Held before him in his gloved hands was an old-school Homburg hat. His face was deeply lined, with pain as well as age, Darcy thought, and what remained of his gray hair was buzzed to a fuzz. Yes, she said. He fumbled in his pocket and dropped his hat. Darcy bent and picked it up. When she straightened, she saw that the elderly gentleman was holding out a leather-cased identification folder. In it was a gold badge and a picture of her caller, looking quite a bit younger, on a plastic card. Holt Ramsey, he said, sounding apologetic about it. State Attorney General's office. I'm sorry as hell to disturb you, Mrs. Anderson. May I come in? You'll freeze standing out here in that dress.
Please, she said and stood aside.
She observed his hitching walk and the way his right hand went unconsciously to his right hip, as if to hold it together, and a clear memory rose in her mind. Bob sitting beside her on the bed, her cold fingers held prisoner by his warm ones. Bob talking, gloating, actually.
I want them to think Beatty's dumb, and they do, because they're dumb. I've only been questioned a single time, and that was as a witness, about 2 weeks after B.D. killed the Moore woman. An old guy with a limp, semi-retired.
And here that old guy was, standing not half a dozen steps from where Bob had died, from where she had killed him. Holt Ramsey looked both sick and in pain, but his eyes were sharp. They moved quickly to the left and right, taking in everything before returning to her face.
Be careful, she told herself. Be oh so careful of this one, Darcellan. How can I help you, Mr. Ramsey?
Well, one thing, if it's not too much to ask, I could sure use a cup of coffee. I'm awfully cold. I've got a state car, and the heater doesn't work worth a darn. Of course, if it's an imposition.
Not at all. But I wonder, could I see your identification again?
He handed the folder over to her equably enough and hung his hat on the coat tree while she studied it.
This R.E.T. stamped below the seal, does that mean you're retired?
Yes and no.
His lips parted in a smile that revealed teeth too perfect to be anything but dentures.
Had to go, at least officially, when I turned 68, but I've spent my whole life either in the state police or working at SAG. State Attorney General's office, you know. And now I'm like an old fire horse with an honorary place in the barn. Kind of a mascot, you know.
I think you're a lot more than that, she thought.
Let me take your coat.
Nope, I think I'll wear it. Won't be staying that long. I'd hang it up if it was snowing outside, so I wouldn't drip on your floor. But it's not. It's just boogery cold, you know. Too cold to snow, my father would have said. And at my age, I feel the cold a lot more than I did 50 years ago, or even 25.
Leading him into the kitchen, walking slowly so Ramsey could keep up, she asked him how old he was.
78 in May.
He spoke with evident pride.
If I make it, I always add that for good luck. It's worked so far. What a nice kitchen you have, Mrs. Anderson. A place for everything and everything in its place. My wife would have approved. She died 4 years ago. It was a heart attack. Very sudden. How I miss her. The way you must miss your husband, I imagine.
His twinkling eyes, young and alert, increased pain-haunted sockets, searched her face. He knows.
I don't know how, but he does.
She checked the buns basket and turned it on. As she got cups from the cabinet, she asked, "How may I help you today, Mr. Ramsay? Or is it Detective Ramsay?"
He laughed, and the laugh turned into a cough. "Oh, it's been donkey's years since anyone called me detective. Never mind Ramsay, either. If you go straight to Holt, that'll work for me. And it was really your husband I wanted to talk to, you know. But of course he's passed on. Again, my condolences. And so that's out of the question." "Yep, entirely out of the question."
He shook his head and settled himself on one of the stools that stood around the butcher block table. His top coat rustled. Somewhere inside his scant body, a bone creaked.
"But I tell you what, an old man who lives in a rented room, which I do, although it's a nice one, sometimes gets bored with just the TV for company. And so I thought, what the hell? I'll drive on down to Yarmouth and ask my few little questions just the same. She won't be able to answer many of them," I said to myself. "Maybe not any of them, but why not go anyway? You need to get out before you get pot-bound," I said to myself.
"On a day when the high is supposed to go all the way up to 10 degrees, she said, "in a state car with a bad heater."
But I do have my thermals on," he said modestly.
"Don't you have your own car, Mr. Ramsay?"
I do,
he said, as if this had never occurred to him until now.
"Come sit down, Mrs. Anderson. No need to lurk in the corner. I'm too old to bite."
"No, the coffee will be ready in a minute," she said. She was afraid of this old man. Bob should have been afraid of him, too. But of course, Bob was now beyond fear.
"In the meantime, perhaps you can tell me what you wanted to talk about with my husband."
"Well, you won't believe this, Mrs. Anderson."
"Call me Darcy, why don't you?"
"Darcy,"
he looked delighted.
"Isn't that the nicest old-fashioned name?"
"Thank you. Do you take cream?"
"Black as my hat, that's how I take it. Only I like to think of myself as one of the white hats, actually. Well, I would, wouldn't I? Chasing down criminals and such. That's how I got this bad leg, you know, high-speed car chase way back in 89. Fella killed his wife and both of his children. Now, a crime like that is usually an act of passion, committed by a man who's either drunk or drugged or not quite right in the head."
Ramsay tapped his fuzz with a finger arthritis had twisted out of true.
"Not this guy. This guy did it for the insurance. Tried to make it look like a, whatcha call it, home invasion. I won't go into all the details, but I sniffed around and sniffed around. For 3 years, I sniffed around. And finally, I felt I had enough to arrest him. Probably not enough to convict him, but there was no need to tell him that, was there?"
"I suppose not," Darcy said.
The coffee was hot, and she poured. She decided to take hers black, too, and to drink it as fast as possible. That way the caffeine would hit her all at once and turn on her lights.
"Thanks," he said when she brought it to the table. "Thanks very much. Your kindness itself. Hot coffee on a cold day. What could be better? Mulled cider, maybe. I can't think of anything else. Anyway, where was I? Oh, I know. Dwight Chaminot. Way up in the county, this was. Just south of the Haynesville Woods."
Darcy worked on her coffee. She looked at Ramsay over the rim of her cup, and suddenly it was like being married again. A long marriage, in many ways a good marriage, but not in all ways. The kind that was like a joke. She knew that he knew, and he knew that she knew that he knew. That kind of relationship was like looking into a mirror and seeing another mirror, a hall of them going down into infinity. The only real question here was what he was going to do about what he knew. What he could do.
Well, Ramsay said, setting down his coffee cup and unconsciously beginning to rub his sore leg. The simple fact is, I was hoping to provoke that fella. I mean, he had the blood of a woman and two kiddies on his hands, so I felt justified in playing a little dirty. And it worked. He ran, and I chased him right into the Haynesville woods, where the song says there's a tombstone every mile. And there we both crashed on Wicket's Curve, him into a tree and me into him, which is where I got this leg, not to mention the steel rod in my neck.
I'm sorry. And the fellow you were chasing, what did he get?
Ramsay's mouth curved upward at the corners in a dry-lipped smile of singular coldness. His young eyes sparkled.
He got death, Darcy. Saved the state 40 or 50 years of room and board in Shawshank.
You're quite the hound of heaven, aren't you, Mr. Ramsay? Instead of looking puzzled, he placed his misshapen hands beside his face, palms out, and recited in a sing-song schoolboy's voice.
I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways. And so on.
You learned that in school?
No, ma'am. In Methodist Youth Fellowship, lo, these many years ago. Won a Bible, which I lost at summer camp a year later. Only I didn't lose it, it was stolen. Can you imagine someone low enough to steal a Bible?
Yes, Darcy said. He laughed.
Darcy, you go on and call me Holt. Please, all my friends do.
Are you my friend? Are you? She didn't know, but of one thing she was sure. He wouldn't have been Bob's friend. Is that the only poem you have by heart, Holt?
Well, I used to know The Death of the Hired Man, he said, but now I only remember the part about how home is the place that, when you go there, they have to take you in. It's a true thing, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. His eyes, they were a light hazel, searched hers. The intimacy of that gaze was indecent, as if he were looking at her with her clothes off. And pleasant for perhaps the same reason.
What did you want to ask my husband, Holt? Well, I already talked to him once, you know, although I'm not sure he'd remember if he was still alive. A long time ago, that was. We were both a lot younger, and you must have been just a child yourself, given how young and pretty you are now. She gave him a chilly, spare-me smile, then got up to pour herself a fresh cup of coffee. The first one was already gone. You probably know about the Beatty murders, he said.
The man who kills women and then sends their ID to the police?
She came back to the table, her coffee cup perfectly steady in her hand. The newspapers dine out on that one. He pointed at her, Bob's finger gun gesture, and tipped her a wink.
Got that right, yes, sir. If it bleeds, it leads. That's their motto. I happened to work the case a little. I wasn't retired then, but getting on to it. I had kind of a reputation as a fellow who could sometimes get results by sniffing around, following my, what you call them,
instincts? Once more with the finger gun, once more with the wink, as if there were a secret and they were both in on it.
Anyway, they'd send me out to work on my own, you know. Old limping Holt shows his pictures around, asks his questions, and kind of, you know, just sniffs. Because I've always had a nose for this kind of work, Darcy, and I never really lost it. This was in the fall of 1997, not too long after a woman named Stacy Moore was killed. Name ring a bell?
I don't think so, Darcy said.
You'd remember if you'd seen the crime scene photos. Terrible murder. How that woman must have suffered. But of course, this fellow who calls himself Beatty had stopped for a long time, over 15 years, and he must have had a lot of steam built up in his boiler, just waiting to blow. And it was her that got scalded. Anyway, the fellow who was SAG back then put me on it. Let old Holt take a shot, he says. He's not doing anything else, and it'll keep him out from underfoot. Even then, old Holt was what they called me, because of the limp, I should imagine. I talked to her friends, her relatives, her neighbors out there on Route 106, and the people she worked with in Waterville. Oh, I talked to them plenty. She was a waitress at a place called the Sunnyside Restaurant there in town. Lots of transients stop in because the turnpike's just down the road. But I was more interested in her regular customers, her regular male customers.
Of course you would be, she murmured.
One of them turned out to be a presentable, well-turned-out fella in his mid or early 40s. Came in every 3 or 4 weeks, always took one of Stacy's booths. Now, probably I shouldn't say this, since the fella turned out to be your late husband, speaking ill of the dead. But since they're both dead, I kind of figure that cancels itself out, if you see what I mean.
Ramsay ceased, looking confused. You're getting all tangled up, Darcy said, amused in spite of herself. Maybe he wanted her to be amused. She couldn't tell. Do yourself a favor and just say it. I'm a big girl. She flirted with him? Is that what it comes down to? She wouldn't be the first waitress to flirt with a man on the road, even if the man had a wedding ring on his finger.
Nah, that wasn't quite it. According to what the other waitstaff told me. And of course you have to take it with a grain of salt, because they all liked her. It was him that flirted with her. And according to them, she didn't like it very much. She said the guy gave her the creeps.
That doesn't sound like my husband, or what Bob had told her for that matter.
Nah, but it probably was your husband, I mean. And a wife doesn't always know what a hubby does on the road, although she may think she does. Anyway, one of the waitresses told me this fella drove a Toyota 4Runner. She knew because she had one just like it. And do you know what? A number of the Moore woman's neighbors had seen a 4Runner like that out and about in the area of the family farm stand just days before the woman was murdered. Once only a day before the killing took place.
But not on the day.
No, but of course a fella as careful as this Beatty would look out for a thing like that, wouldn't he?
I suppose.
Well, I had a description, and I canvassed the area around the restaurant. I had nothing better to do. For a week, all I got was blisters and a few cups of Mercy coffee. None as good as yours, though. And I was about to give up. Then I happened to stop at a place downtown. Mickelson's Coins. Does that name ring a bell?
Of course. My husband was a numismatist, and Mickelson's was one of the 3 or 4 best buy and sell shops in the state. It's gone now. Old Mr. Mickelson died and his son closed the business.
Yeah, well, you know what the song says. Time takes it all in the end. Your eyes, the spring in your step, even your friggin' jump shot, pardon my French. But George Mickelson was alive then.
Upright and sniff in the air, Darcy murmured.
Holt Ramsay smiled. Just as you say. Anyway, he recognized the description. Why, that sounds like Bob Anderson, he says. And guess what? He drove a Toyota 4Runner.
Oh, but he traded that in a long time ago, Darcy said, for a
Chevrolet Suburban, wasn't it?
Yes. Darcy folded her hands and looked at Ramsay calmly. They were almost down to it. The only question was which partner in the now-dissolved Anderson marriage this sharp-eyed old man was more interested in.
Don't suppose you still have that Suburban, do you?
No, I sold it about a month after my husband died. I put an ad in Uncle Henry's swap guide, and someone snapped it right up. I thought I'd have problems with the high mileage and gas being so expensive, but I didn't. Of course, I didn't get much. And 2 days before the man who'd bought it came to pick it up, she had searched it carefully, from stem to stern, not neglecting to pull out the carpet in the cargo compartment. She found nothing, but still paid $50 to have it washed on the outside, which she didn't care about, and steam cleaned on the inside,
which she did.
Ah, good old Uncle Henry's. I sold my late wife's Ford the same way.
Mr. Ramsay.
Holt.
Holt. Were you able to positively identify my husband as the man who used to flirt with Stacy Moore?
Well, when I talked to Mr. Anderson, he admitted he'd been in the Sunnyside from time to time. He admitted it freely. But he claimed he never noticed any of the waitresses in particular. Claimed he usually had his head buried in paperwork. But of course I showed his picture from his driver's license, you understand? And the staff allowed as how it was him.
Did my husband know you had a particular interest in him?
No, as far as he was concerned, I was just old Limpin' Lenny looking for witnesses who might have seen something. No one fears an old duck like me, you know.
I fear you plenty, she thought.
It's not much of a case, she said, assuming you were trying to make one.
No case at all,
he laughed cheerily, but his hazel eyes were cold.
If I could have made a case, me and Mr. Anderson wouldn't have had our little conversation in his office, Darcy. We would have had it in my office. Well, you don't get to leave until I say you can. Or until a lawyer springs you, of course.
Maybe it's time you stop dancing, Holt.
All right, he agreed. Why not? Because even a box step hurts me like hell these days. Damn that old Dwight Chemineau anyway. And I don't want to take your whole morning, so let's speed this up. I was able to confirm a Toyota 4Runner at or near the scene of two of the earlier murders, what we call Beattie's first cycle. Not the same one, a different color. But I was also able to confirm that your husband owned another 4Runner in the 70s.
That's right, he liked it, so he traded for the same kind.
Yep, men will do that. And the 4Runner's a popular vehicle in places where it snows half the damn year. But after the Moore murder, and after I talked to him, he traded for a Suburban.
Not immediately, Darcy said with a smile. He had that 4Runner of his well after the turn of the century.
I know, he traded in 2004, not long before Andrea Honeycutt was murdered down Nashua Way. Blue and gray Suburban. Year of manufacture, 2002. A Suburban of that approximate year and those exact colors was seen quite often in Mrs. Honeycutt's neighborhood during the month or so before she was murdered. But here's the funny thing.
He leaned forward.
I found one witness who said that Suburban had a Vermont plate, and another, a little old lady of the type who sits in her living room window and watches all the neighborhood doings from first light to last, on account of having nothing better to do, said the one she saw had a New York plate.
Bob's had Maine plates, Darcy said, as you very well know.
Of course, but plates can be stolen, you know.
What about the Shaverstone murders, Holt? Was a blue and gray Suburban seen in Helen Shaverstone's neighborhood?
I see you've been following the Beattie case a little more closely than most people. A little more closely than you first let on, too.
Was it?
No, Ramsay said. As a matter of fact, no. But a gray over blue Suburban was seen near the creek in Amesbury where the bodies were dumped.
He smiled again while his cold eyes studied her.
Dumped like garbage.
She sighed. I know.
No one could tell me about the license plate of the Suburban seen in Amesbury, but if they had, I imagine it would have been Massachusetts, or Pennsylvania, or anything but Maine.
He leaned forward.
This Beattie sent us notes with his victim's identification. Taunting us, you know, daring us to catch him. Perhaps part of him even wanted to be caught.
Perhaps so, Darcy said, although she doubted it.
The notes were printed in block letters. Now, people who do that think such printing can't be identified, but most times it can. The similarities show up. I don't suppose you have any of your husband's files, do you?
The ones that haven't gone back to his firm have been destroyed, but I imagine they'd have plenty of samples. Accountants never throw out anything.
He sighed. Yeah, but a firm like that, it'd take a court order to get anything loose. And to get one, I'd have to show probable cause, which I just don't have. I've got a number of coincidences, although they're not coincidences in my mind, and I've got a number of
well, propinquities, I guess you might call them, but nowhere near enough of them to qualify as circumstantial evidence. So I came to you, Darcy. I thought I'd probably be out on my ear by now, but you've been very kind.
She said nothing. He leaned forward even further, almost hunching over the table now, like a bird of prey. But hiding not quite out of sight behind the coldness in his eyes was something else. She thought it might be kindness. She prayed it was.
Darcy, was your husband Beatty?
She was aware that he might be recording this conversation. It was certainly not outside the realm of possibility. Instead of speaking, she raised one hand from the table, showing him her pink palm.
For a long time, you never knew, did you?
She said nothing, only looked at him, looked into him the way you looked into people you knew well. Only you had to be careful when you did that because you weren't always seeing what you thought you were seeing. She knew that now.
And then you did. One day, you did.
Would you like another cup of coffee, Holt?
Half a cup, he said.
He sat back up and folded his arms over his thin chest.
Maud gave me acid indigestion, and I forgot to take my Zantac pill this morning.
I think there's some Prilosec in the upstairs medicine cabinet, she said. It was Bob's. Would you like me to get it?
I wouldn't take anything of his, even if I was burning up inside.
All right, she said mildly, and poured him a little more coffee.
Sorry, he said. Sometimes my emotions get the better of me. Those women, all those women, and the boy with his whole life ahead of him. That's worst of all.
Yes, she said, passing him the cup. She noticed how his hand trembled and thought this was probably his last rodeo, no matter how smart he was.
And he was fearsomely smart. A woman who found out what her husband was very late in the game would be in a hard place, Ramsay said.
Yes, I imagine she would be, Darcy said.
Who'd believe she could live with a man all those years and never know what he was? Why, she'd be like a, what do you call it, the bird that lives in a crocodile's mouth.
According to the story, Darcy said, the crocodile lets that bird live there because it keeps the crocodile's teeth clean. Eats the grain right out from between them. She made pecking motions with the fingers of her right hand. It's probably not true, but it is true that I used to drive Bobby to the dentist. Left to himself, he'd accidentally, on purpose, forget his appointments. He was such a baby about pain. Her eyes filled unexpectedly with tears. She wiped them away with the heels of her hands, cursing them. This man would not respect tears shed on Robert Anderson's account. Or maybe she was wrong about that. He was smiling and nodding his head.
And your kids, they'd be run over once when the world found out their father was a serial killer and torturer of women, then run over again when the world decided their mother had been covering up for him, maybe even helping him, like Myra Hindley helped Ian Brady. Do you know who they were?
No.
Never mind then. But ask yourself this. What would a woman in a difficult position like that do?
What would you do, Holt?
I don't know. My situation's a little different. I may be just an old nag, the oldest horse in the fire barn, but I have a responsibility to the families of those murdered women. They deserve closure.
They deserve it, no question. But do they need it?
Robert Shaverstone's penis was bitten off. Did you know that?
She hadn't.
Of course she hadn't.
She closed her eyes and felt the warm tears trickling through the lashes. Did not suffer my ass, she thought.
And if Bob had appeared before her, hands out and begging for mercy, she would have killed him again. His father knows,
Ramsay said, speaking softly.
And he has to live with that knowledge about the child he loved every day.
I'm sorry,
she whispered.
I am so, so sorry.
She felt him take her hand across the table.
Didn't mean to upset you.
She flung it off.
Of course you did. But do you think I haven't been? Do you think I haven't been? You nosy old man.
He chuckled, revealing those sparkling dentures.
Nah, I don't think that at all. Saw it as soon as you opened the door.
He paused, then said deliberately,
I saw everything.
And what do you see now?
He got up, staggered a little, then found his balance. I see a courageous woman who should be left alone to get after her housework. Not to mention the rest of her life.
She also got up. And the families of the victims? The ones who deserved closure? She paused, not wanting to say the rest. But she had to. This man had fought considerable pain, maybe even excruciating pain, to come here, and now he was giving her a pass. At least she thought he was. Robert Shaverstone's father?
The Shaverstone boy is dead, and his father's as good as.
Ramsay spoke in a calm, assessing tone Darcy recognized. It was a tone Bob used when he knew a client of the firm was about to be hauled before the IRS, and the meeting would go badly.
Never takes his mouth off the whiskey bottle from morning till night. Would knowing that his son's killer, his son's mutilator, was dead change that? I don't think so. Would it bring any of the victims back? Nah. Is the killer burning in the fires of hell for his crimes right now, suffering his own mutilations that will bleed for all of eternity? The Bible says he is. The Old Testament part of it anyway, and since that's where our laws come from, it's good enough for me. Thanks for the coffee. I'll have to stop at every rest area between here and Augusta going back, but it was worth it. You make a good cup.
Walking him to the door, Darcy realized she felt on the right side of the mirror for the first time since she had stumbled over that carton in the garage. It was good to know he had been close to being caught, that he hadn't been as smart as he assumed he was. Thank you for coming to visit, she said as he set his hat squarely on his head. She opened the door, letting in a breeze of cold air. She didn't mind. It felt good on her skin. Will I see you again?
Nah. I'm done as of next week. Full retirement. Going to Florida. I won't be there long, according to my doctor.
I'm sorry to hear
He abruptly pulled her into his arms. They were thin, but sinewy and surprisingly strong. Darcy was startled, but not frightened. The brim of his Homburg bumped her temple as he whispered in her ear,
You did the right thing,
and kissed her cheek. 20. He went slowly and carefully down the path, minding the ice. An old man's walk. He should really have a cane, Darcy thought. He was going around the front of his car, still looking down for ice patches when she called his name. He turned back, bushy eyebrows raised.
When my husband was a boy, he had a friend who was killed in an accident.
Is that so?
The words came out in a puff of winter white.
Yes, Darcy said. You could look up what happened. It was very tragic. Even though he wasn't a very nice boy, according to my husband.
No?
No. He was the sort of boy who harbors dangerous fantasies. His name was Brian Delahanty, but when they were kids, Bob called him B.D.
Ramsay stood by his car for several seconds, working it through. Then he nodded his head.
That's very interesting. I might have a look at the stories about it on my computer. Or maybe not. It was all a long time ago. Thank you for the coffee.
Thank you for the conversation.
She watched him drive down the street. He drove with the confidence of a much younger man, she noticed, probably because his eyes were still so sharp, and then went inside. She felt younger, lighter. She went to the mirror in the hall. In it, she saw nothing but her own reflection. And that was good.
Afterword. The stories in this book are harsh. You may have found them hard to hear in places. If so, be assured that I found them equally hard to write in places. When people ask me about my work, I've developed a habit of skirting the subject with jokes and humorous personal anecdotes, which you can't quite trust. Never trust anything a fiction writer says about himself. It's a form of deflection, and a little more diplomatic than the way my Yankee forebears might have answered such questions. It's none of your business, chummy. But beneath the jokes, I take what I do very seriously, and have since I wrote my first novel, The Long Walk, at the age of 18. I have little patience with writers who don't take the job seriously, and none at all with those who see the art of story fiction as essentially worn out. It's not worn out, and it's not a literary game. It's one of the vital ways in which we try to make sense of our lives and the often terrible world we see around us. It's the way we answer the question, how can such things be? Stories suggest that sometimes, not always, but sometimes, there's a reason. From the start, even before a young man I can now hardly comprehend started writing The Long Walk in his college dormitory room, I felt that the best fiction was both propulsive and assaultive. It gets in your face. Sometimes it shouts in your face. I have no quarrel with literary fiction, which usually concerns itself with extraordinary people in ordinary situations. But as both a reader and a writer, I'm much more interested by ordinary people in extraordinary situations. I want to provoke an emotional, even visceral reaction in my listeners. Making them think as they listen is not my deal. Because if the tale is good enough and the characters vivid enough, thinking will supplant emotion when the tale has been told and the book set aside, sometimes with relief. I can remember reading George Orwell's 1984 at the age of 13 or so with growing dismay, anger, and outrage, charging through the pages and gobbling up the story as fast as I could. And what's wrong with that? Especially since I continue to think about it to this day when some politician, I'm thinking of Sarah Palin and her scurrilous death panel remarks, has some success in convincing the public that white is really black, or vice versa. Here's something else I believe. If you're going into a very dark place, like Wilf James's Nebraska farmhouse in 1922, then you should take a bright light and shine it on everything. If you don't want to see, why in God's name would you dare the dark at all? The great naturalist writer Frank Norris has always been one of my literary idols, and I've kept what he said on this subject in mind for over 40 years. I never truckled. I never took off my hat to fashion and held it out for pennies. By God, I told them the truth. But Steve, you say, you've made a great many pennies during your career. And as for truth, that's variable, isn't it? Yes, I've made a good amount of money writing my stories. But the money was a side effect, never the goal. Writing fiction for money is a mug's game. And sure, truth is in the eye of the beholder. But when it comes to fiction, the writer's only responsibility is to look for the truth inside his own heart. It won't always be the reader's truth or the critic's truth, but as long as it's the writer's truth, as long as he or she doesn't truckle or hold out his or her hat to fashion, all is well. For writers who knowingly lie, For those who substitute unbelievable human behavior for the way people really act, I have nothing but contempt. Bad writing is more than a matter of shit syntax and faulty observation. Bad writing usually arises from a stubborn refusal to tell stories about what people actually do. To face the fact, let us say, that murderers sometimes help old ladies cross the street. I have tried my best in Full Dark, No Stars, to record what people might do and how they might behave under certain dire circumstances. The people in these stories are not without hope, but they acknowledge that even our fondest hopes and our fondest wishes for our fellow men and the society in which we live may sometimes be vain, often even. But I think they also say that nobility most fully resides not in success but in trying to do the right thing, and that when we fail to do that or willfully turn away from the challenge, hell follows. 1922 was inspired by a nonfiction book called Wisconsin Death Trip, 1973, written by Michael Lessie, and featuring photographs taken in the small city of Black River Falls, Wisconsin. I was impressed by the rural isolation of these photographs and the harshness and deprivation in the faces of many of the subjects. I wanted to get that feeling in my story. In 2007, while traveling on Interstate 84 to an autographing in western Massachusetts, I stopped at a rest area for a typical Steve King health meal, a soda, and a candy bar. When I came out of the refreshment shack, I saw a woman with a flat tire talking earnestly to a long-haul trucker parked in the next slot. He smiled at her and got out of his rig. "Need any help?" I asked. "No, no, I got this," the trucker said. The lady got her tire changed, I'm sure. I got a Three Musketeers and the story idea that eventually became Big Driver. In Bangor, where I live, a thoroughfare called the Hammond Street Extension skirts the airport. I walk 3 or 4 miles a day, and if I'm in town, I often go out that way. There's a gravel patch beside the airport fence about halfway along the extension, and there any number of roadside vendors have set up shop over the years. My favorite is known locally as Golf Ball Guy, and he always appears in the spring. Golf Ball Guy goes up to the Bangor Municipal Golf Course when the weather turns warm and scavenges up hundreds of used golf balls that have been abandoned under the snow. He throws away the really bad ones and sells the rest at the little spot out on the extension. The windshield of his car is lined with golf balls. A nice touch. One day when I spied him, the idea for Fair Extension came into my mind. Of course, I said it in Derry, home of the late and unlamented clown Pennywise, because Derry is just Bangor masquerading under a different name. The last story in this book came to my mind after reading an article about Dennis Rader, the infamous BTK, bind, torture, and kill murderer, who took the lives of 10 people, mostly women, but two of his victims were children, over a period of roughly 16 years. In many cases, he mailed pieces of his victim's identification to the police. Paula Rader was married to this monster for 34 years, and many in the Wichita area where Rader claimed his victims refused to believe that she could live with him and not know what he was doing. I did believe, I do believe, and I wrote this story to explore what might happen in such a case if the wife suddenly found out about her husband's awful hobby. I also wrote it to explore the idea that it's impossible to fully know anyone, even those we love the most. All right, I think we've been down here in the dark long enough. There's a whole other world upstairs. Take my hand, constant reader, and I'll be happy to lead you back into the sunshine. I'm happy to go there, because I believe most people are essentially good. I know that I am. It's you I'm not entirely sure of. Bangor, Maine, December 23rd, 2009.
The End. You've been listening to Full Dark, No Stars by Stephen King, narrated by Craig Wasson and Jessica Hecht. This book is copyrighted 2010 by Stephen King. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. Call us toll-free or log on to recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers, order another recorded book, or to read author interviews and narrator profiles. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.